Let me begin with a couple of things. First of all, just to say, nice to be here. Next to say, for those of you who don't know, I have really, really bad eyesight. So if I need to look at my notes, I'm going to do something like that. So just ignore that if I do that. Also, when the time comes to read passages from Scripture, which we'll do a fair amount of, just to try to prove that what I'm saying really is the Bible, I'll get a change of voice. It'll mean that I don't have to read, and you'll get a different voice. So I think Roger's going to read for us for this first session. Can you hear me, by the way? I'm sort of on the back. No, good. Fantastic. Is this on, Dan?
Yes, yeah.
Good. The third thing to say is I love taking questions. So I don't just want you to sit there and absorb what I say. I know I'm going to be wrong in places. I just haven't figured out where. So when you ask questions, I will learn. Also, inevitably, when you expound a book, when you expound the whole Bible, I've made a number of judgment calls, and you might be interested in asking questions as to why I've done it this way instead of that way. No two people, I think, I will do the overview in exactly the same way. That's not because there are different things God is doing. It's just because you make choices about how you're going to put the bits together, how you're going to simplify. God doesn't waste words. And if he could have said everything he was going to do in 3 hours, he wouldn't have bothered writing whatever it is, 1,200 pages over 2,000 years to reveal it. So I've had to make a lot of choices, simplifications, drawn straight lines where the Bible's drawn slightly more complicated lines, and other people will do it differently. But you might want to ask questions about why I thought this was the better way to do it. I love taking questions. Those who know me know I love taking questions too much. And every time you ask a question, I will answer it and we'll go off in all sorts of directions, even if I'm about to deal with it in 5 minutes' time in my notes anyway. So I've learned over the years to ration myself, and every 15 minutes or so, we'll pause for a question break. So we'll see how that works. But if you do have a question, there will be a question break coming up. Make a note, and when the time comes for the questions, you can take it. Let me recap very briefly what we were saying last night, partly because a big breakfast might have driven it out, partly for the benefit of the Hortons. First of all, just to say the overview is the most exciting thing we do. Roger wrote up last night on that board, but I rubbed it up because I'm going to need it, the board that is, that the overview is an opportunity of the lifetime. And I think that's right. Very, very few churches ever do something like try to study the whole Bible and see the sweep of all that God is doing all in one place. It's an extremely exciting thing. It's not just an exciting thing. I think it's a very necessary thing because God wrote his revelation out. God revealed his plan and what he's planning to do, not in a systematic theology, not as an encyclopedia of articles on topics like the Holy Spirit, the cross, the atonement, justification, but as a narrative with a beginning, a storyline, a plot, and an end. And we don't understand what he's doing unless we try to read it the way he chose to reveal it. And when we do that, we will discover that what he is doing is actually much more exciting and much more revolutionary than we might have thought. Actually much more exciting and much more revolutionary than if we do look at it by topics or just a snippet here and a snippet there. It will help us, therefore, be changed by it. It'll help us apply it. It'll help us deal with some of the big theological issues of our time, as we said briefly last night. Now, I'll come back to some of that at the end of this morning's session briefly, and Roger will pick it up in much more depth, I think, tomorrow morning. But I think it's important to remember all the way through what I'm doing this morning that the overview is not an academic exercise. It is hearing the living God speak. It is profoundly revolutionary. It is doing justice to the way he decided to reveal, and it will help us apply and deal with many theological issues of our time. Let's begin by looking at the plot of the story of the Bible. And I think many of you have done Bible overviews at some point or other, either within RML or in different contexts. So I'll whiz through some of the basic stuff quite quickly so we can spend a little bit more time on the stuff which maybe you haven't thought about quite so much or where I've made slightly different judgment calls to other people and we might want to think about why I've done what I've done. obviously, with a plot, with a narrative like the Bible, as I said, there's a beginning and there's an end. And in order to understand how it works, it's really worth beginning by looking at the beginning and the end. So we see where the whole thing starts and we see where it ends. And that will give us some idea of what the whole thing is all about. Let's begin at the beginning, very sensible place. In Genesis 1 and 2, we see God creating the world. He creates it with his word. He creates it with effortless power. It is exactly as he wants it. It is very, very good. And that phrase you will know in Genesis 1 repeats, and he saw it was good, and he saw it was good, and he saw it was good at the end of every day, until the last one he saw, and it was very good. And God created humankind on the sixth day as the pinnacle of his creation. And he relates to humankind, to us, in a special way. He ruled them, Adam and Eve, as he did the rest of creation, but he also loved them, and he cared for them. And he gave them great responsibilities to look after the garden. And he gave them all they needed. So he gave them a home, a garden to live in. He gave them work, something to do to give them fulfillment. He gave Adam a wife when he realized it wasn't good. Well, not realized, but because it wasn't good for Adam to be alone. So God really cared for and looked after and provided for humankind. In Genesis 3, however, Adam and Eve rebel against God, and as a result, God punished them, and his good world is spoiled. And that really is the beginning of the story for our purposes. So let's pause on this and have a look at it in a little bit more detail. You should all have a handout, by the way, on which most of this is written. I like these little magnets. They're great fun. It allows you to do all sorts of cunning things. Like, I don't want you to see that half there. Bother. Actually, I can even hide that bit. These were meant to be OHP slides, but OHP is so 20th century. They don't have an OHP machine here. So you're going to have that instead. If you can't see, that's a reason for pushing your chair forward a little bit. Good. So let's run through some of the elements. Genesis 3 is the fall, and all sorts of things went wrong in Genesis 3. First of all, the good relationship between God and humankind is spoiled. God is angry, God sends them away, God condemns them to pain and toil, but it's not a mechanistic. This happens, and therefore, slightly like dropping a cup of coffee, inevitably it hits the ground. God is deliberately rejecting them. There's now a relationship of hostility and enmity between God and man. Roger, can you read Genesis 3, 16 to 19, please?
To the woman, God said, "I will surely multiply your pain in childbearing. In pain you shall bring forth children. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you." And to Adam he said, "Because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree of which I commanded you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread, till you return to the ground. For out of it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return."
Thank you. So you can see a lot of bad things there, but God is doing them. God is making them happen. In particular, God drives human beings from their home in verses 23 to 24. Roger, please.
"Therefore the Lord God sent him out from the Garden of Eden to work the ground from which he was taken. He drove out the man, and at the east of the Garden of Eden he placed the cherubim and a flaming sword that turned every way to guard the way to the tree of life."
Thank you. So he throws them out and prevents them coming back. And he cursed his creation and human beings. Can you read verse 14 and again and verse 17b again, please?
"The Lord God said to the serpent, 'Because you have done this, cursed are you above all livestock and above all the beasts of the field. On your belly you shall go, and dust you shall eat all the days of your life.'" And 17b, "Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life."
Thank you. So the creation is clearly cursed there. The serpent is cursed, the ground is cursed. I think I want to argue that humans are cursed as well. It's fashionable to say, in some circles, for people to say, well, humans aren't cursed. It's never said that they're cursed. But when they're told that they will die, that they're expelled from Eden, that they will gain their bread through pain and hard work, that they'll have children through pain. That sounds like a curse to me. The fact that the word cursed isn't used doesn't seem to affect the fact that is what curse is, being made to find things hard and painful and die in the end. Fourthly, instead of living forever, human beings now die. Roger, can you read again, please, verse 19 and 22 to 24?
By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground. For out of it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. And 24, he drove out the man, and at the east of Garden of Eden he placed the cherubim and a flaming sword that turned every way to guard the way to the tree of life.
Thank you. So four things that go wrong as a result of Adam and Eve's sin, and one thing which caused it all. That didn't happen just by chance. It happened because Adam and Eve rebelled against God, and that is the cause of the wrecked world. And I think it's well worth distinguishing, as you do the overview, the cause, the thing that made it all happen, and the result or the effects of it all. They sinned, God cursed. And holding those two concepts distinct in your mind, I think, is a very useful way of thinking about what happens in the Bible. Let's flip to the very end of the Bible now and have a look at what happens when we get to Revelation 21 and 22. Because that's what we're in set up. Created, fallen, cursed. That's the beginning. Now let's look at the end, Revelation 21 and 22. And when we look at the end in Revelation 21 and 22, we see that all the things that went wrong in the fall have been put right in the new creation. Amazing, look at that. Just appears. So, first of all, God is again in a relationship with human beings where he cares for them and gives them all they need. Roger, can you read 21 verses 3 and 4 for us, please?
And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people. And God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain any more, for the former things have passed away.
Thank you. And so can you see that it's not just that God is there, God is now relating rightly. God is wiping away the tears, God is looking after them, God is with them, God is loving them. God is now for them, whereas in Genesis 3 he was against them. God has now made a wonderful new creation, and he's placed his people in it, in a glorious city, as their home. Roger, chapter 21, verses 1 and 2, please.
Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband.
Thank you. And there's again blessing, not curse. Can you read 21 verse 4 again, please, and also 22 verse 3?
He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain any more, for the former things have passed away. 22, is it 4 or 3? No longer will there be anything accursed, but the throne of God and of the Lamb will be in it, and his servants will worship him.
So, thank you. So nothing more accursed in there. And the final one of the effects, the results, was death. And that is removed. So 21:4, which Roger just read for us, but I'll get him to read it again just so we ram it home. And also 22:2.
He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away. And 22, through the middle of the streets of the city, also on either side of the river, the tree of life with its 12 kinds of fruit, yielding its fruit each month. The leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations.
Thank you. So no death, and you now have access to the tree of life again, whereas in Genesis 3, the way to the tree of life was guarded by the angel with a flaming sword. And all that is possible because there's now nothing sinful in the New Jerusalem, as we see in chapter 21, verse 27.
But nothing unclean will ever enter it, nor anyone who does what is detestable or false, but only those who are written in the Lamb's Book of Life.
Thank you. So do you see how everything that went wrong in the fall has now been put right in the new creation? And just pause there. Even at that level, even in the first 10 minutes or so of the overview, you suddenly realize the significance of seeing the whole thing as a narrative plot. If you just look at Revelation 21, 22, it's jolly exciting, isn't it, to see that God is now with his people and there's a new creation and there's no death, and it's all very exciting. But when you see how that is put right, everything that went wrong right at the beginning of the story, it suddenly gains a lot more force. It's not just as good, but everything that's been wrong, that God made go wrong, he's now making go right again. Does it make some sort of sense? It suddenly gains a huge amount more force just by putting it in the context of that's the end of the story and that was the beginning. And we'll see that all the way through. By seeing where it comes in the plot, it suddenly gains a lot more force and a lot more excitement. So, this is wonderful, by the way. I asked for a big whiteboard expecting something like that. I've never had a whiteboard like this before. So this is really exciting. I'm going to try to make use of the whole width of it. But I'm colorblind. Is that black or red?
It's black.
Fantastic. So, right on this side over here, you get creation. Actually, I don't need to be quite so abstemious. And then you get this massive fall. Fall, I'll say, where they sort of end up right down there in the pits, and there's a little wiggle there to say that if I had sort of a lot further in the board, I'd just keep going down because things have gone horribly, horribly, horribly wrong. And right over here, and you are going to need a big sheet of paper, you get the new creation. And in Genesis 3, we didn't have to go very far. Genesis 3, we were right down there in the pits. And by Revelation 21, 22, we're right up there in the sky. And the story of the Bible is how God gets us from there to there.
Sorry, keep going. I thought it was then.
Right. Let me just say a couple of things, and then I will pause and we'll have a question break. What I've done there is I've selected four things that went wrong and four things that went right. They are, I think, the most important. They're not the only things. So even between last year and this year, I have changed the way I look at the overview just slightly by taking out an area. So one other thing which you can look and runs all the way through the Bible as well is the fact that relationships between people are cursed and put right. So part of the curse in Genesis 3 is there's now hostility between Adam and Eve. God says that Adam and Eve will now be at one another's throats in Genesis 3. And by the time you get to Revelation 21, 22, there's now peace between the nations. And you can trace the theme of relationships between people put right as well all the way through. There's a lot more happening in the Bible than this. This is an oversimplified picture of what's happening. But it says everything that is necessary. And there's a large element in the overview to which less is more. If you try to put in all the detail of what's happening, it actually gets so complicated that people lose the basic plot. So one, it's always a challenge when you study the Bible and teach the Bible, always, to get the balance between how much you put in and how clear you are. The more you put in, the more faithful you are and the less clear you are to the person who's hearing it for the first time. I think my view is beginning to harden, that is particularly now that we've been doing the overview for 20 years, we've discovered more and more and more and more, and we wanted to teach people everything we know. But the poor people coming through haven't been studying it for 20 years. This is their first time of seeing it. And if you tell them everything you know, they will just go, that's much too hard, I give up. Don't understand what's happening. So we want to try to keep it as simple as possible so they get the basic plot, which is really exciting. And then they have the joy as they look at the Bible in years to come to think, oh, and that works as well, exactly the way I saw everything else work. And that too. So there are lots and lots of things we could add. And when you look at passages, you'll think, ah, but I could say that because that works as well. And oh, look, that works as well. And you'll get really excited, particularly if you've done the overview before, because you will be seeing extra things that work and fit. But just remember the people you're teaching haven't. And if you put those extra things in, it might excite you, but it'll confuse them. And it's a really difficult balancing art. And I'm not sure, there's no right answer. It's not that all is simpler is better, because sometimes it's too simple and you lose some of the force. But just keep in mind, am I being too complicated? Are my group getting excited, or are they getting lost? So I don't have the answer, but I thought I'd at least raise the issue for you to be thinking about over the course of the year. Let me pause there and take a question break. Any questions people want to ask on either the beginning or the end, or making judgment calls about how simple and difficult to make it? Yeah.
You said it's important to distinguish between the cause of the fall and the effects of the fall.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain a bit about why you think it's important?
Mm. I will, but I won't just now. That's a brilliant question. But I think one of the reasons for holding the two distinct is because as the Bible story unfolds, the way God deals with the cause and the way he deals with the effects are distinct, as we will see. And therefore, as we see the whole story, hopefully that'll become very clear. If it hasn't by the end of the morning, ask that question again. But once the whole picture's up on the board, I think we'll be able to see very clearly why they're different. Any other questions? Yeah.
The other one I've sometimes heard emphasized on that is work and the kind of relationship with work. And have you made a judgment call not to include work in the, as a kind of separate category in the curse?
What do you mean? That work is...
Work is cursed.
Yes.
And that's applied to our lives, and that's why it's futile.
Yeah. I think work is one of those interesting things that's big for us today, because we live in a society that really values work, particularly in the Western world where we choose our work, as opposed to, I have to tail the field because there's nothing else I can do, it's that or starve. And therefore, we want to give work a lot of value. The Bible doesn't make that much of work. It's there, no question it's there, but it's not a huge, huge deal. So work is there mentioned as part of the curse, but it's not particularly picked up in Revelation 21, 22. I think it will be put right, but in the Bible plot, in the way God revealed it, it's quite a minor detail. Though it might be big for us in the 21st century West. Any other questions? Mitch?
Just a more practical one. You said don't get too bogged down in detail and such, and yeah. When teaching was studies. Is that the same for us when studying an overview? Try and keep it simpler, keep a broad perspective on the big themes and such, as
yeah.
opposed to being bogged down?
Yeah, yeah. So I think at every level, you can cope with more detail. So the more often you've done it, and the better you are as a Bible student, the more detail you can cope with. But you need to keep thinking, if you're beginning to lose the plot of the whole Bible, then you've probably into too much detail. But it'll therefore probably mean the super slob will be slightly more detailed than the slob, which will be slightly more detailed than the group. But if at any stage you're losing the idea of the whole plot, you're slightly defeating the object of the overview, because the overview is not just to study 30 selected passages through the Bible. The point of the overview is to see how they connect to tell the overall story. So if you're losing that connectivity, you're defeating the object of what we're seeking to do in the overview. And exactly where the breakpoint is for each group or each individual is how much detail you can cope with, where it's enriching the plot as opposed to confusing the plot. That's on a per person, per group basis. Any other questions? Yeah.
You have, I'm sure, for a good reason, put the new creation line a little bit higher than the original creation line.
For a very good reason.
If you're going to cover it later on, please ignore the question for now. But is it simply just to do with the fact you've got the additional line on the new creation side of the box, Jesus on the throne, and the implication that that's just going to make the new creation better than the original creation?
That is exactly what I'm going to cover in about 30 seconds' time. So it's the very next point of my notes. So hold far on that one. But the right question to be asking, as proven by the fact I'm about to deal with it. Anything else? Good, let me press on. There'll be other question breakpoints time. Let me deal with Ed's question at that point. So what I've focused on so far is the similarities between what went wrong at the fall and the way that was put right at the new creation, how those things match. But there are some differences as well between the new creation, things which turn up which aren't there in the fall. So most obviously, if you're looking at the text rather than what I've written up, the fact that in Genesis 3 we're in a garden and in Revelation 21, 22 we're in a city, it should make you think, that's different. What's the significance? There are lots and lots of differences like that, and virtually all of them have significance. It's amazing. The more you know the Bible, the more you read Revelation 21, 22, and you think, oh, that's interesting. Oh, that picks up that little random detail floating around somewhere or other. So just let me give you a tiny little detail, which you don't want to teach your group because it's one a good example of a confuse. But it's the sort of thing which, if you know the Bible a little bit, is something which excites, which is Revelation 22, God's servants see his face. But all the way through the Bible, you can't see his face. Moses is told, no one can see my face and live. But actually, in the new creation, you can. So just a tiny detail picked up from basically 1,000 pages earlier, Moses said, told, no one can see my face and live. Revelation 22, all God's servants see his face. That sort of thing, just there's just lots and lots of it. But the most important thing of them all is not the obvious city versus garden. The most important, the one that matters most, the most difference, is that Jesus, the Lamb, is on the throne with the Father. Roger, can you read chapter 22, verses 1 to 3, please?
Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, bright as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb through the middle of the streets of the city. Also on either side of the river, the tree of life with its 12 kinds of fruit yielding its fruit each month. The leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. No longer will there be anything accursed, but the throne of God and of the Lamb will be in it, and his servants will worship him.
Thank you. So it's not just God on the throne. It's the Lamb on the throne with him. And the city is the bride of the Lamb. Can you read chapter 21, verses 9 and 10, please?
Then came one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues and spoke to me, saying, come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. And he carried me away in the spirit to a great high mountain and showed me the holy city Jerusalem coming down out of heaven from God.
Thank you. So, can you see how Jesus on the throne is a new component there? It doesn't match anything in the fall. You're not told at the fall and you don't have access to the Lamb, or the Lamb has just divorced you. It's not picking up something that went wrong there. It's a new element. And so the answer to Ed's question, why have I drawn it higher, is because there are lots of new things, all of which suggest it's better. The city is better than the garden, because the city in that society symbolized security and community and all sorts of things like that, as opposed to the wilderness where the wild animals ate you and you were nervous in the middle of the night. Cities are different now. lots of little details. So Genesis 2, one of the rivers, there's gold in that place. City, the streets are paved with gold. Just dozens of little details like that that says that's better. But the most important is Jesus is on the throne there. That's why I drew it higher. So do you see how at the end of the story, God's people have the most fantastic relationship with God and his Son? They have a great home, a wonderful home. They have immense blessings. It really is the ultimate happy ending. It's the sort of fairy tale ending of you've married the perfect groom in the wonderful home, and it does really last forever. You ride off into the sunset, and breakfast tomorrow morning is not a letdown. And it's true. It's not just a Hollywood makeup. It really is what we're in the middle of and what God has in store for us in eternity. So that is the really exciting thing that we're looking at, how God gets us from the fall to that ultimate happy ending. The Bible story is how God gets them there. So let's go back now to the beginning and trace this through. So back to Genesis. In Genesis, and I think we're now just over the page, Genesis 4 to 11 show us that sin and death are universal. Adam and Eve's sin was not a one-off phenomenon. Everybody sins by Genesis 6. And we see that all the way through the whole Bible, everybody sins. And we see that obviously in the world around us today. Everybody sins. And that ongoing sin deserves ongoing punishment. It's not that they sinned, they got punished, and that's it. There's nothing more that can happen. As they continue sinning, God continues punishing. So the flood is the first great example. Things trundle along, and then God curses them further in the flood. What's the story of the flood doing there? The story of the flood, I think, is showing us just how radical God's salvation needs to be when it comes. Just think about what people say around us today. You know, he behaved badly because his upbringing was bad. Bad family. Bad environment. It's the other people around me who led me astray. Look at what God did there. God got rid of everything except the best family, the most righteous family. I mean, Noah's children had the best possible privileges, didn't they? They didn't have bad neighbors. They had the best family. They had a good example in their parents. The world was washed clean, and God started again with the best family he had. And by and large, or basically, within a chapter, they're exactly where they were. Nothing changed. So when God comes to actually put right the problem of fall to get us there, something very, very much more radical than the flood is necessary. And again, do you see how putting something like the flood in the context of the whole Bible story gives it a completely different slant? We're not just saying, look, here's an example of how God rescues, which it is. We're seeing how little it accomplishes relative to what's necessary, which is getting us back up there. And suddenly we realize just how radical what God is actually going to do needs to be, as opposed to all the silly solutions that people come up with today for making the world better. I'm not saying that they aren't valuable. I'm not saying that doing something like improving environments and families and all things aren't valuable. But just realize how little they can actually achieve. In the grand scheme, nothing at all. Let me just pause on that for a second to say one other judgment call I have made. It's well worth, as you work through the Bible, reading the story forward. Okay, this is, again, a judgment call people make. You can look at something like the flood and say, oh, look, here is a picture of how Jesus saves us. And you can see all sorts of parallels between what happens in this rescue and what happens in the rescue of us by Jesus. And the New Testament does pick that up in someone like 1 Peter 3. And all the way through the Bible, you can go back and say, oh, look, you can see Jesus there. And it's true. And it's, as I said, and therefore it won't be wrong to teach that. But I think you lose the force of the story if you do that. God didn't reveal Jesus until quite late in the day, as Roger very helpfully pointed out yesterday evening. God revealed Jesus about two-thirds of the way through. Read the story the way that God revealed it, not revealing Jesus, and actually you begin to understand it from quite a different angle. You begin to realize how important it is that Jesus comes, because this isn't actually solving anything. Whereas if you just see Jesus there, then yes, you've seen Jesus, but you haven't actually learned how much Jesus needs to do for you, because that actually, how limited that was. I haven't explained that very clearly, but does that make some sort of sense? So I think my suggestion is read the story forward. Don't keep jumping to Jesus. People will get quite frustrated and they'll want to say, oh, look, but there's Jesus there. But I think the answer is, yep, but God hasn't revealed him yet. So let's do it God's way and wait and let that unfold in God's good time. Now, some people will say, but doesn't that run the risk of not reading the Old Testament as a Christian book? Some of you might have heard that if you don't see Jesus everywhere, we're reading it more like the Jews would read it. I don't think that's right. I think that you're reading it as a Christian book, as long as you read it as a story which is leading to Jesus. It's on a trajectory which has Jesus as its climax. Does that make sense? As long as you're reading it as part of that trajectory, you don't actually need to read Jesus explicitly in anywhere, everywhere, for it to be a Christian book. So that's the, that is a judgment call I've made for today, and it's one which I think you might want to think about, which I think I'd recommend, but different people take different views on that. But I'll pause there for a question break. Anyone want to engage with that or anything else I've said?
Well, does that remind you that therefore we shouldn't mention Jesus in studies until, I don't know, we have been
just... I think you can mention him occasionally. I mean, it's a judgment call. I've mentioned Jesus already, haven't I? At this point in Revelation 21, 22, by, when we jumped ahead, and by contrast. But I wouldn't do it every week. I just do it occasionally, just to make sure that people remember. Well, no, I don't think you'll need to, because I think your battle will be to stop people trying to mention him every week. So I think he'll keep coming up. I just wouldn't make a big deal of it until the Bible does. So again, do it the way the Bible did. The base assumption that you will always stand you in good stead is God doesn't make mistakes. Okay, so if God chose not to mention Jesus at this point, run with the way God did it. It's always a fail-safe way of getting it right. There'll be places where God makes it more explicit that we might want to mention Jesus, and at that point you can. But if he hasn't, don't try to read him in. When we read Genesis 6, God doesn't say, oh, look, and Noah is a picture of the one who is about to come, so don't mention Jesus. Any other questions?
Dad? So, for example, things like the serpent crusher, which is, you know, weird, you know, it's clearly Jesus, you would just say that this is the characteristics of what we're looking for. You just wouldn't jump to talking about Jesus.
I wouldn't jump to Jesus because I don't think that's, at this point, it's at all clear that's Jesus. It simply says there'll be enmity between the woman's offspring and the serpent. It's not saying that there's going to be just one offspring at that point. It could be her entire line will hate snakes and want to kill snakes, which is true. Now, in the end, when we get to the New Testament, we realize that was talking about Jesus. But I think it's, again, the story works better if you don't talk about Jesus. And when you discover Jesus, you think, oh, yes, look, we had him as a serpent crusher right at the beginning. And there's that sense of excitement rather than the, oh, I'm not really persuaded he's the serpent crusher, you know. Battle all the way through. Any other questions? Yep, Mitch.
How's that play out when it comes to sort of application of the passage, bearing in mind that obviously we are in a very different place to people who are in the Old Testament?
Brilliant question. And that's where I'll try to end up this morning, where Roger will pick it up, I think, tomorrow morning. So exactly the right question, but come back to it later on. Roger?
So I was saying, tomorrow I'm going to try and help us think, given this approach, how do we apply it? That'll be the first session. And how do we write a study in light of it? That'll be the second session. So we'll pick up some of this. When do you mention Jesus? How, as a Christian, do you respond to the story, but still read it bit by bit going through the story? I think Michael's thinking about the false starts and the limited solutions that the Old Testament gives you do help you really appreciate the full solution when Jesus comes. Whereas if you're always saying, oh, this reminds me of the full solution, and every week you're just saying, yeah, the full solution, we've got the full solution, rather than we haven't got the full solution through the Old Testament, yeah, and then really appreciating it when it arrives.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I was trying to say very, very badly a few minutes ago. So if all you see in the flood was, this is a picture of Jesus, you haven't realized that something so drastic and so radical didn't solve it. Jesus does much, much, much more, which is the point of the flood, and actually much more exciting and much more applicable, I think, than just saying, oh, look, there's a fairly limited picture of Jesus. Any other questions? Good. We will plow on because of time. What I'd like you to do now in pairs They just spend 5 minutes looking at what is promised to Abraham, because the big step forward in God's plan comes with a promise to Abraham in Genesis 12. Because at this point, as God begins his plan to put right what went wrong at all, he chooses one man, he promises him some reversal of all that's gone wrong. So let's spend 5 minutes in pairs looking at what is promised to Abraham. This is where I need the flip chart. So these are the passages I'd like you to look at, please. Genesis 12, 1 to 7. Genesis 13, verses 14 to 17. And Genesis 17, verses 3 to 8. So spend 5 minutes in your groups just looking at those passages, thinking, what has God promised Abraham? Which corresponds to what went wrong at the fall. Don't cheat. It's on the next table. So you could just cheat, but don't do that. Look at the text and think to yourself, look at that table. Think, that's what went wrong. Now, how was what was promised to Abraham in any sense connected with what's gone wrong so far? Right. Let's draw stumps there. That was just meant to give you a taster. What we see, I hope you've at least begun to see, is that in lots of the ways in which things went wrong in the fall, God is promising some sort of reversal to Abraham. So let's whiz through some of them quite quickly. Adam and Eve lost their wonderful close relationship with God. God was now anti them, hostile, in Genesis 3. But Abraham and his descendants are promised that they will be God's people and he will be their God. So, Roger, can you read chapter 17, verses 7 and 8 for us, please?
Yep. And I will establish my covenant between me and you and your offspring after you throughout their generations for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and to your offspring after you. And I will give to you and to your offspring after you the land of your sojournings, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God.
Thank you. And that's just the explicit statement of it. Obviously, all the way through God's dealings with Abraham, he's for Abraham. He's doing good things to Abraham. He's caring for Abraham. Secondly, Adam and Eve lost Eden, but Abraham is promised that he and his descendants will have a land of their own. Can you read chapter 12, verses 6 and 7, please?
Abraham passed through the land to the place at Shechem, to the oak of Moreh, and at that time the Canaanites were in the land. Then the Lord appeared to Abraham and said, to your offspring I will give this land. So he built there an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him.
Thank you, they will have a land. Adam and Eve and creation were cursed. Abraham, however, is blessed, and all people will be blessed through him as well. Chapter 12, verses 2 and 3.
And I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed.
Thank you. Blessings all round, unless you curse Abraham. Adam and Eve were told they would die. But Abraham is told that he will have many descendants and be a great nation. I'll explain that, but let me get Roger to read the bit first, and then I'll explain that one. Chapter 13, verses 15 and 16.
For all the land that you see, I will give to you and to your offspring forever. I will make your offspring as the dust of the earth, so that if one can count the dust of the earth, your offspring also can be counted.
Thank you. Now, let me just pause on that one, because it's not obvious that many descendants corresponds to death in any way whatsoever. But actually, if you think about it, throughout most of history, and still today in many cultures and many nations, you're considered to live on in your descendants. So it's not an exact match, but if you die, it doesn't matter quite so much if you have children who will keep the name going and the line going. And that actually is the picture of the Abrahamic covenant in general. So God promises Abraham some reversal of the fall in every area that he previously punished them and cursed So in every area of the results of the fall, the effects, God promises some element of reversal, but it is only some element of. So they lost the Garden of Eden, which is a perfect garden, a perfect home, and they gain Canaan. Now, I know Canaan's called the land of milk and honey, but it is actually a fairly dry and arid, scrubby bit of the Middle East. Okay, it's not that, it's better than what they had. It's better than stuff around it, but compared to Eden, it's not a patch on the real thing. Similarly, Adam and Eve died, and their descendants all died. They're now told that Abram's now told that he'll have descendants and a line, which is better than your line will die out, but it's not the same as you live forever. So it is some reversal, but a bit of a pale shadow reversal. Also notice that the issue of sin is not mentioned, because God is not yet talking about dealing with the cause of the fall. So in answer to Vic's question, why distinguish between the two? Because all the way through the Bible, God, the way God deals with the effects and the way he deals with the cause is not the same. And when Abraham, the covenant to Abraham is first made, he doesn't really mention the cause. He just mentions the effects. Stuff like, you've lost your land, you're going to die, you will be cursed, I'm anti you. All of those areas, God's saying, I'm going to begin to fix that. But the sin stuff, he doesn't say anything about in particular. So, what we have here is what's known as the Abrahamic covenant. The trouble with having a big board compared to a small one is I'm still trying to restrict myself too much to the left-hand side. So you have the Abrahamic covenant at that point. Right. Let me make a couple of comments about the Abrahamic covenant. It's beginning to put right what went wrong at the fall, but it's only partial. So it doesn't go up the whole way, it just goes up to there when they lost all of that. Because, as I said, things like Canaan is not Eden, descendants is not you live forever. But it is actually a step in the right direction. Secondly, it's a step in the right direction, but it is only a promise. So when I changed color from black to blue, that was entirely intentional. The reality of Abraham's life is still there. He doesn't gain, he gains one field, which he buys with his own money. He gains one descendant, well, two if you include Ishmael, but to the end of his life, he spends most of his life with Sarah being barren. So he doesn't actually gain that much, but he is promised something for the future. And you can already begin to see some of the agenda for the rest of the Bible. Two agenda items are put on the table right up front here. First, that promise is not yet the real thing. How does that promise become a promise of that? Secondly, reality and promise are now distinct. There's a disjunct between what he's experiencing and what he's got promised. How is that disjunct going to be bridged? How is what he experiences, his descendants' experience, going to correspond to what's been promised? And that is the other agenda item for the rest of the Bible. So the promise at one level is very limited. It's a partial reversal, it's only a promise. But nevertheless, the Abrahamic covenant is one of the most important turning points in the entire Bible story. Because for the first time since the fall, there is now actually some hope for things to get better. Up to this point, there's no real hope. You can read hope into the serpent crusher, but if you read it forward, the serpent crusher isn't actually offering that much. It's just offering ongoing battle. It's not actually saying that Adam and Eve get any better because of the serpent crusher. Noah doesn't get any promise of things getting better. He just gets a promise that God won't again judge it that way. There's no hope, really, reading forward until Abraham. Now there's hope. It's a big, big, big step forward. The key issue, as I said, is how is that gap between promise and reality going to be bridged? But the other key issue is who is going to benefit from them? Everyone was affected by the fall. Every single human being is affected by the fall. But it is only Abram and his descendants who are promised the blessings. Who are these descendants? So Genesis 12:3 does say all nations will be blessed through you. It's not at all clear what that means. It's a little clue of something more. But the explicit promises are to Abram and his descendants. And from that point onwards, if you like, there's a little bit of a distinction between Abram and his descendants. Do lines. I'm not going to develop the do because it'll be too complicated. We'll just follow the Abrahamic descendant line for quite a lot of the rest of the morning. But a lot of the rest of the Bible is now about how God will fulfill the promises he's made and who exactly Abraham's descendants are. Let me pause and take questions. Any questions? Yes, sorry. The two branches are, the top one for the moment is Abraham's descendants, and the bottom one is the rest of mankind, because that has affected all mankind up to that point. Everything up to that point is all mankind. From here on, you distinguish between Abraham's descendants and everyone else. Any other questions?
Sorry, what? Sorry, just on that. Why doesn't that middle line go to where the blue line is?
Because Abraham hasn't yet got what is promised. So he's promised the whole land of Canaan. He's got one field. He's promised descendants as many as the sand on the seashore. He's got one child in the line. So that's why it's only marginally better. So it's marginally better than what the rest of the world is, because he's doing pretty well. He's fairly prosperous. But compared to what's promised, it's not a patch.
You said there's no hope, but he did make a covenant with Noah, didn't he, chapter 9?
Yeah.
And so in some ways it hasn't, there has been something. Why do we start with the Abrahamic rather than the Noahic?
Because what is promised to Noah isn't actually hope for things being better. So what's promised to Noah is, I will not again judge the world like that. So all that Noah is promised is the bottom won't fall out of everything again. He's not promised things will get any better. So if you just had Noah, it could just bumble along there forever and ever and ever. Any other questions? Good. I'm running. Go on. Sorry, Ed. Yes, my eyesight's so bad you really need to. Or just speak up. Go on, Ed.
Forgive me if I missed it, but did you actually provide a brief summary of what the line is actually intended to represent? So is it just sort of how good it seems things are going in the narrative, or is there a more sort of theologically correct way of describing what the line's doing?
The black line. The black line, if you like, is what people are actually experiencing, how good or bad it is. So the higher it is, the better their experience. The lower it is, the worse their experience. And it's obviously a very crude schematic. If God could have done it by diagrams, he'd have done it by diagrams. But I find it helpful to think visually like this. Any other questions? Good. Because of time, I'm going to plow on because, as always, I've spent too long answering questions. I mean, we had schedule. The next thing that happens is the Exodus. So for 400 years, Abraham and his descendants do not inherit what God has promised. In fact, things actually get worse. As I said, initially things look as though they're good. And then, as you all know the story, they go to Egypt and they become slaves. And turns down and things get worse because they're now slaves in Egypt. And that all goes on for 400 years. But then God intervenes again and rescues his people in the Exodus. In the Exodus, God comes, as you know, he takes his people out of Egypt with his powerful hand, and he leads Israel through the desert to Mount Sinai, where he tells them what it means to be his people and how they can inherit what he has promised to give Abraham's descendants. He makes, in other words, the Mosaic Covenant. So you get things getting worse, and then God comes and he rescues people. That's the Exodus. But even as he rescues them, he makes a new covenant, the Mosaic covenant. We'll look at that in a moment. But first of all, just note, God is not simply rescuing Israel from something, from slavery. He's rescuing them for something. And this is a really big step forward. So Noah wasn't rescued for anything. He was rescued from a watery death for nothing in particular. Just he comes out and the world continues as it was before. Israel is rescued from Egypt, and they are rescued for something, for the beginning of the fulfillment of what God has promised. That's why the promises are so important. You've now actually got a goal you're heading for. And that addition of rescued for something is absolutely crucial in the Bible story. He's rescuing them to be his people, people in relationship with him, people who are blessed by him, people he provides for and gives good things for, people he will give a land to. God is beginning to fulfill his promise of a reversal of the fall. But as I said, even as he does that rescue, he makes another great covenant with them, the Mosaic covenant. And in the Mosaic covenant, God re-promises all the elements of the Abrahamic covenant. So let's have a look at Leviticus 26 to see some of that happening. Let me, by the way, say the Mosaic covenant is huge. If the Abrahamic covenant is described in maybe half a dozen chapters in Genesis, the Mosaic covenant begins in Exodus 19 when they turn up at Mount Sinai, and I think goes right through to Deuteronomy 28. It certainly goes right through to Deuteronomy 28. Some people think it goes right through to the end of Deuteronomy, but I think the last five or so chapters of Deuteronomy, six chapters of Deuteronomy, aren't actually part of the Mosaic covenant. They're describing what happens to the nation of Israel in their life under the Mosaic covenant. It's a prophecy of what's going to happen. The covenant, therefore, ends at 28. But let's look at chapter 26, which is one of the great summaries of the covenant. There are a couple of great summaries. Leviticus 26 is one of them. So first of all, God re-promises a relationship with him. Can you read Leviticus 26, verses 9 to 12, please, Rog?
I will turn to you and make you fruitful and multiply you and will confirm my covenant with you. You shall eat old store long kept, and you shall clear out the old to make way for the new. I will make my dwelling among you, and my soul shall not abhor you. And I will walk among you and will be your God, and you shall be my people.
Thank you. So he's really for them and now doing good things to them, walking with them. And most importantly, he's dwelling with them. That is a big step forward. And you will know that one of the big elements of the Mosaic covenant is God makes his dwelling with them. You get endless chapters describing the tabernacle and the ark and how you relate to God who's now dwelling in your midst. That's a really big step forward we'll come back to. He also re-promises the land and blessings. Can you read chapter 26, verses 4 to 6, please?
Then I will give you your rains in their season, and the land shall yield its increase, and the trees of the field shall yield their fruit. Your threshing shall last to the time of the grape harvest, and the grape harvest shall last to the time for sowing, and you shall eat your bread to the full, and dwell in your land securely. I'll give you peace in the land, and you shall lie down, and none shall make you afraid. I will remove harmful beasts from the land, and the sword shall not go through your land.
Thank you. So land and blessing, and also many people. Can you read verse 9 again, please?
I will turn to you and make you fruitful and multiply you, and will confirm my covenant with you.
Thank you. They'll be fruitful. So all the elements of the Abrahamic covenant get re-promised. So can you see how these four categories we've talked about, it went wrong there in the fall, promises of being put right in Abraham, re-promised in Moses. But the Mosaic covenant develops the Abrahamic covenant in two ways. First of all, it spells out and extends the promises. You realize just how good they are. They, if you like, they get better, which is why I've lifted the bar slightly there. You're promised something more. God dwelling with you is even better than him being for you. He's now for you, and he's going to dwell with you in your midst. And that's probably the most important way it gets better, but lots of other things happen as well to just make you realize, yeah, this is even better than what was promised to Abraham. Most crucially, and this is the really, really key element, conditions are now attached to these blessings. Roger, can you read Leviticus 26, verse 3, please?
If you walk in my statutes and observe my commandments and do them, then I'll give you.
Thank you. So if you do all this, I will give you. If you don't do all of these, then God will actually not only not give you, he will do the opposite of all of that. As I said, there are several big summaries. Probably the two most important summaries of the Mosaic Covenant are Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28. And to see the negative, Deuteronomy 28 is probably an even better place. So flip forward to Deuteronomy 28, which is right at the end of the Mosaic Covenant, and see what God says he'll do if they don't obey. So, first of all, if they don't obey, he will send more curses against them. Deuteronomy 28, verses 58 to 61.
58, if you're not careful to do all the words of this law that are written in this book, that you may fear this glorious and awesome name, the Lord your God, then the Lord will bring on you and your offspring extraordinary afflictions, afflictions severe and lasting, and sicknesses grievous and lasting. And he will bring upon you again all the diseases of Egypt, of which you were afraid, and they shall cling to you. Every sickness also, and every affliction that is not recorded in the book of this law, the Lord will bring upon you until you are destroyed.
Thank you. So can you see he's not just saying, well, I won't give you what I promised. He's actually saying, I will make things much worse. I'll bring upon you extraordinary afflictions. If you like, making the punishments of the fall even worse, like he did at the flood. So if you obey, you get better things. If you disobey, you don't just go back down there. Things are going to be even worse. And it's not just on the level of curse and blessings he will do that. He will kill the people and take them away from their land. Can you read 62 to 63, please?
Whereas you were as numerous as the stars of heaven, you shall be left few in number, because you did not obey the voice of the Lord your God. And as the Lord took delight in doing you good and multiplying you, so the Lord will take delight in bringing ruin upon you and destroying you, and you shall be plucked off the land that you are entering to take possession of it.
Thank you. You'll be left few in number and you'll be plucked out of the land. And God will actually be hostile to them. He'll be against them again and they will no longer relate to him. Verses 64 to 68, please.
And the Lord will scatter you among all peoples from one end of the earth to the other. And there you shall serve other gods of wood and stone, which neither you nor your fathers have known. And among these nations you shall find no respite, and there shall be no resting place for the sole of your foot. But the Lord will give you there a trembling heart and failing eyes and a languishing soul. Your life shall hang in doubt before you. Night and day you shall be in dread and have no assurance of your life. In the morning you shall say, if only it were evening. And at evening you shall say, if only it were morning, because of the dread that your heart shall feel and the sights that your eyes shall see. And the Lord will bring you back in ships to Egypt, a journey I promised you should never make again. And there you shall offer yourselves for sale to your enemies as male and female slaves, but there will be no buyer.
Thank you. So God is actually hostile to them. Look at all the way through those 10, 11 verses. God is saying, I will do this. I will drive you away. And I'll actually get you to the stage where I will make you worship gods of stone and wood that you don't know. I'm going to drive you away from me. I'll have nothing to do with you if you don't obey. So, if you like, if they obey, they get that. If they disobey, they get worse than they had down at the Exodus, because they'll be sent back as slaves to Egypt, and no one will want to buy them. They'll be even worse than they were when they were slaves there. And the reason for that, I need another color, let's go for green, is sin. So, let's put in an extra thing here. It wasn't that fall didn't just happen by chance. It happened because of sin. They will get the promises of the Mosaic Covenant if
obey. Whereas if they disobey, they'll get worse. Can you see that green, or is it too faint? Good. Thank you. Good. I'm about to have a question break because I can feel questions brewing. They ought to be brewing at this point. But the reason why conditions now come in is because as God begins to put right what went wrong at the fall, he can't ignore that sin thing. So the thing that caused it to go wrong does need to be dealt with. He said to Abraham, I will deal with the effects, but he doesn't mention the cause. But now that something's actually beginning to happen in reality, he can't ignore that cause. So something needs to be done. They need to start obeying and stop disobeying if they're going to benefit. So again, in answer to Vic's excellent question about why distinguish cause and effects, just because it does enables you to do things like spot that Abraham doesn't deal with the cause, but when you get to Moses, it does come in quite a big way that if you obey, if you disobey, becomes a big deal at the point of Moses. So we now have various things on the table. You've got the black, which represents reality, what they're actually experiencing. You've got the green, which represents the cause of it all. And you've got the blue, which represents what will one day happen, God will do. So both the cause and the effects of the fall must be dealt with before the fall is fully reversed. At this point in the story, God is taking responsibility for dealing with the effects, the result, the blue line. God is saying, I will do that bit. But he's saying to Israel, you have to do that bit of obey as opposed to disobey. So he's, if you like, at this point, it's shared responsibility for how it's all going to be put right. Now, I'm going to just make a couple of comments and then throw open questions, and then we're going to have a loo break and coffee break. This is one of the most controversial points of the whole overview, as many of you will be aware. Some people will say, but surely there were conditions on Abraham. Abraham had to obey, didn't he? He had to go out of the land of Ur into the land of Canaan. He had to do things like offer his son Isaac. What's the difference? This is really important. It's not that there are no conditions there and there are conditions there. You need to think, who has to obey the conditions? In every covenant in the Bible, apart from the Mosaic, the person who obeys the covenant is the first person in the line. So when you get to Jesus, Jesus had to obey and Jesus had to go to the cross. But we're not saved by our works. We're saved because Jesus died for us. Jesus obeyed for us. So it's not our works, it's his works. Abraham's descendants benefit because Abraham obeyed. But his descendants keep benefiting whether they obey or not. So Jacob and Isaac are a complete bunch of rotters. And the children are, I mean, read the back half of Genesis. They're complete no-gooders. Simeon and Levi and Judah, they're horrible people. But they still get the promises because Abraham obeyed. Because Noah obeyed, God made the promise that he would never again flood the world. Have you thought about that? Is there anything you can do or not do that will make God flood the world again? No. Because Noah obeyed back then. So, yes, every covenant has some conditions, but every covenant, the condition is only the person to whom the covenant is made, apart from the Mosaic, where each person who's going to benefit has to individually obey if they're going to benefit. That makes that one different. That's where the responsibility is put on the descendants. At that point, they're not told, because Moses obeyed and Moses went before Pharaoh, therefore you will gain the land. No, they're told, if you obey, you'll gain it. If you disobey, you'll lose it. Does that make sense? So that's where it's different. Now let me pause there and take the questions, which I'm sure are bubbling in people's minds. And then we'll have a break.
So
Andy.
The thing you just said, so with the Mosaic one, is it, say you've got 100 people in Israel, 99 obey and one didn't, is it, there's a presumption that the 99 would receive the benefits of the covenant and that one person wouldn't? Or
yeah.
Is it very much a collective, you all have to obey for you to all receive it?
Yes, thank you. By and large, at this point in the story, we're still thinking about the nation as an entire collective. So it's if the nation obeys. If an individual disobeys, if one person disobeys, he's cut off and stoned and destroyed, and the nation as a whole keeps benefiting. So the presumption is, let's look at the nation as a whole. And we'll see as the story develops that actually no one obeys, and therefore just killing off a few people who disobey isn't going to solve the problem, because you don't end up with a core that's obedient. You end up with no one. Roger, was that a finger?
No.
Any other questions? Rob.
So, thank you for what you've done there. It's really helpful to see those two trajectories they could go. I'm just wondering what to do with all the stuff in Deuteronomy where it says that they're going to go down the disobedience line.
Yes.
And particularly, I can't remember where it is in Romans, but we know that they should have seen that the Lord would need to circumcise
yes.
their hearts. So they should have always looked forward to the fact that they were relying on God's grace and not
yes.
their own obedience. I'm just wondering, obviously that would make it overly complicated, but why haven't you included the fact that they should trust God for forgiveness and all those sorts of things? And the fact
yes.
that he would circumcise their hearts?
Yes. I mentioned it briefly, but sufficiently briefly that it wasn't picked up. That bit is in the last few chapters of Deuteronomy. So I think that the Mosaic Covenant begins to be made in Exodus 19 and is concluded in Deuteronomy 28 with a great summary of the Mosaic Covenant in chapter 28. In chapter 29 to 33 of Deuteronomy, Moses then talks about what's going to happen to Israel after his death.
Yeah.
And basically he says, after my death, you will disobey and you will get all the curses. And within that, there's half a chapter, about less than that, maybe about 6 or 7 verses, where he says, and after all those curses have come upon you and you get that, I will come and act again and circumcise your heart. Even though it's a distraction and time, I think we ought to look this one up because I think a lot of people have this as a question. So Deuteronomy 31. Actually, 30, sorry. Roger, can you read Deuteronomy 30, verse 1 and 2, please?
Chapter 30, verse 1. And when all these things come upon you, the blessing and the curse, which I have set before you, and you call them to mind among all the nations where the Lord your God has driven you, and return to the Lord your God, you and your children, and obey his voice in all that I command you today with all your heart and with all your soul, then the Lord your God will restore you.
Thank you. Can you go on to verse 6, I've decided.
Then the Lord your God will restore your fortunes and have compassion on you, and he will gather you again from all the peoples where the Lord your God has scattered you. If your outcasts are in the uttermost parts of the heaven, from there the Lord will gather you, and from there he will take you. And the Lord your God will bring you into the land that your fathers possessed, that you may possess it. And he will make you more prosperous and numerous than your fathers. And the Lord your God will circumcise your heart and the heart of your offspring, so that you will love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, that you may live.
Thank you. So this is part of not so much the Mosaic covenant, but a promise of, a prediction of what will happen eventually. After all these things come upon you, verse 1, in the land that the Lord God scatters you to when you disobey and you end up being scattered and thrown out, then it's not the end of the story, I will come and act. But that's basically all the hope there is. So it's not really part of the Mosaic covenant, but there's a little glimmer of hope even at that point that it's not the end of the story. So when things start going wrong and they end up there, they at least think, oh yes, there was a little bit of a glimmer of a hope they should see. Which is why, by the way, for those of you who did Romans last year or have done it recently enough to remember, you'll know that in Romans 10, Paul contrasts this bit of Deuteronomy with Leviticus. So in Romans 10, I think it's verse 4, Paul says, according to Moses, this is righteousness. Do these things and you will live, quoting Leviticus. But the righteousness according to faith says, so he's pulling them apart. That is contrasted with Moses. And he's quoting Deuteronomy in contrast with Moses. Now, how does that work if they're both part of the Mosaic Covenant? Just very confusing. But if you realize it's not part of the Mosaic Covenant, it's a prediction given by Moses about the future, it then works as a contrast to the Mosaic Covenant. Does that make sense? That's one of the many things which is really quite complicated, which potentially will confuse more than clarifies. But let Roger step in.
Yeah, so to summarize that, we won't teach this in the OPU, but Moses himself warns that the Mosaic Covenant is going to go badly, but promises there's going to be something beyond it. That's the short summary of that last few minutes.
Thank you.
Which we won't cover in the OPU, but it's just worth knowing as leaders. There is, even early in the history of Israel, God himself, through Moses, says this is going to go badly, but there will be a future beyond it. But we'll ignore that because it's extra complexity.
Yeah. And I'm going to draw a line at that point.
One more question on a slightly different thing. On Mosaic Covenant, lots of people would say, I think would be nervous with what you're saying here, because they'd say, surely things like the Ten Commandments are based on grace.
Yes.
So God says explicitly in Exodus 19 and 20, remember, I rescued you out of Egypt, as in I saved you by grace. Now obey my law. So whereas it sounds like you're saying it's not based on grace at all, it's just... Do some works and then I'll bless you.
Yeah, thank you. Exactly. Lots of people will say, but no, God has rescued them. Now they have to obey. It's all grace. But it's not as simple as that, is it? Because that bit in Deuteronomy 28, that's so important, by the way. Those last 10 verses of Deuteronomy 28, from verse 58 to 68, it's well worth reading and rereading. They are absolutely crucial to understanding the Mosaic Covenant. What God says is, I have rescued you, and I will continue rescuing you to give you the land. But if you disobey, I will take it all away again and throw you out of the land and send you back to Egypt, and it'll be worse than before. So it's not so much grace, you've got it and you can't lose it, as more, you've got it on credit. You've bought it on hire purchase or your credit card, but if you don't pay it off, it gets taken away again. Does that make sense? So if I give you a present, it's yours. And you've got it come what may. If you buy something on hire purchase, you've got it, but it's different. If you stop paying back your monthly installments, it gets taken away. Does that make sense? If daddy gives you a house, you've got it. If you buy a house with a mortgage, you've still got it. You're living in it. But stop the mortgage repayments and it gets repossessed. And you've lost it. And that is more like getting it on mortgage, which is why it's not grace.
Anyone want to ask a question on that? Feel free to.
Sorry, tell me to be quiet. Mm.
Go.
But in Romans 10, he seems to blame Israel for seeking to... achieve these things by their own works and not trusting the grace that was promised.
Yes.
So how does that square with what you said there? Sorry, is that clear enough?
It's very clear. I'm wondering whether to deal with it now or later on. That's the only thing. Can you hold that question? It's a very good question, but I think it'll become clearer if we deal with it later on in the morning. So don't forget it, please. Okay. I'll give you the precy. At this point, I think this what I've described here is what God is saying, if you like, what the surface reading of the text. If you don't sort of probe too deeply, if you don't think about it too hard, you get what I've said. Because that's what God says explicitly. Do these things and you'll live. Do these things and you'll be blessed. Don't do these things and I'll take it all away. There is more happening than that, which individuals who have faith can see, but you have to think about it and have faith to see it. But it's easier to see that when we've got further on in the story and look backwards.
Yeah.
If you were, it is, if you were an Israelite at the time, read that chapter in Deuteronomy 28, for example. Read Deuteronomy 28 and think, if I were an Israelite at the time and I didn't know where the story was going after this, how would I hear that? And you realize that in order not to think I'm saved by my works, you really need to have real insight into God and what he's doing in faith. The surface readers do these things and you will live. Any other questions? Good. Let's take a loo break. More questions might come at the end of that. If you have questions, do ask them. If they're not helpful, I'll defer them. But work on the assumption that if you have a question, probably half the room does as well. So be brave and ask, because it'll serve your fellow leaders. We're now well behind schedule. So can we go for a 15-minute break?
So back at 11. Does anyone know where coffee is
available? Yes, it's just next door there. And the milk dispenser squirts to the left, so be careful. That was meant to be 11:20. There we are. How behind schedule are we? We started. So we start again at 11.